Hey, y'all. I'm Erin Haynes, the host of The Amendment, a brand new weekly podcast on gender, politics, and power brought to you by the 19th News and Wonder Media Network. You've probably heard the news that this election year, our democracy is at stake. On The Amendment, I'm breaking down what that actually means, specifically for the marginalized folks who depend on our democracy the most. This is a show that dives past the headlines and gets clear on the unfinished work of our democracy. Listen to The Amendment now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, Brown Girls. Ashanti here, the founder of the Brown Girls Guide to Politics. When we talk about women of color breaking barriers in politics, oftentimes this means referring to the fact that they are the first to do something. On this episode, we talk to three women who are the first women of color to lead their national progressive organizations. Stay tuned to get to know Rana Epstein, the executive director of Move On, Karundi Williams, the executive director of Repower, and Yvette Simpson, the CEO of Democracy for America, to hear how they are shaping the future of the democratic and progressive movements. Very, very excited about this conversation and to be able to bring you three badass women together here in DC. Thank you for replying to my email and wanting to be on the podcast. So we will get started first with your name, your organization, and you're all relatively new in your roles. So what is the favorite part of your new job?
So my name is Yvette Simpson. I'm the CEO of Democracy for America. I love the fact that there is a network of amazing Black women who are doing this work that I get to be sisters with and collaborate with and commiserate with. I was pleasantly surprised at the number of Black and brown women who are in the movement space, who are growing into and leading organizations like this. And I can tell you that the sisterhood has been 100% real. And I love that. And that was a pleasant surprise that, you know, particularly because I'm the first woman to lead my organization and the first woman of color. Just the sisterhood has been amazing. And the way I've been welcomed into the community has been fantastic.
Oh, we love you.
Thank you.
I'm Rana Epting. I'm the executive director at Move On. Happy to be here. I've been in this role since October of this year, or of 2019. My favorite part of being an executive director of Move On is I get to make all the decisions.
Yes, boss lady.
But to be honest, I mean, I've been a chief of staff, a chief of program, a deputy director. I've been a practitioner in the work in campaigns and elections and organizing and leadership development for a long time. I've had a lot of opinions. I've pushed a lot of EDs and presidents to approve proposals I've put before them and organize to get the support in either in labor or in advocacy organizations to do certain things. And I've never had the decision-making power until at this level. And I like being able to make the decisions and to make the decisions based on years of experience and what I know is important in order to lead in the organizing world and the organizing space that we are in. And I'll tell you, like, the amount of decisions I make on a day-to-day basis as an executive director has probably quadrupled. Yeah. And at some points, I was talking with Karundi earlier, it's exhausting.
Yes.
Like, really, I have to gotta decide something in our budget that's around, you know, $10,000 and next to a question around how do we drive the next version of our impeachment campaigning and what is the strategy and our posture in that moment. So the level of decision making, the amount of decision making at some points is exhausting, but it's also exhilarating and I love it.
She likes to make decisions. I don't. So I'm Karundi Williams. I am the executive director at Repower. And I have been in the role for about 5 months, and so since the summer. And I'd say the thing I love about my job so far the most is I get to work for an organization that's smaller in scale than other organizations that I've worked for before. And those organizations have always felt like it's so hard to bring about change because you have such bureaucracies that you have to go through and levels of bureaucracy. And now I'm in charge at a pretty small organization comparatively to what I've been in before, and now I can actually move and change quickly at a quicker pace. So I really love that about my job. But I was also telling Rana, the thing I love the most is we have our mission and vision is around centering people of color and women of color specifically in the work. And it's not a tagline. It actually shows up in the work we do every day. And that's really powerful. And so that's the thing I enjoy the most is that we are being about what we say we're about. And it's not just about, you know, it looks good on paper. It actually shows up in the work every day. And that's incredibly enjoying for me, satisfying for me.
I think we can all agree we love when organizations actually live their values. Absolutely. And not just state their values. And listening to the three of you talk, I actually got a little emotional because this is the first time I would have ever been able to put together even a panel discussion like this of women of color leading these progressive organizations. So many of the discussions we've had this season on the BGG, honestly, last year, 5 years, 10 years ago, they did not exist. And I think it's important for us to talk about the fact that everyone does start somewhere. And for the majority of us as Black and Brown women, it is at the local level. So how did you get started at the local level? What brought you into politics?
I'll go. For me, actually, when I thought about that, it's it was policymaking that actually drew me into politics. I really enjoyed thinking about how we can actually effectuate change through policymaking. And politics is a tool, and it's a path to doing that. Politics affects our daily lives every single day. And so for me, I was drawn into, wow, I can actually engage in a process that actually go about making change. And so policy was actually what drew me to politics at the local level. And at the local level, you can also feel the impact of the changes that you can make. At the federal level, it's a little harder because, you know, it's everywhere. But in your locality, in your mayor's race, in the city council race, in your school board, in your small community, politics actually matters every single day. And the decisions that these policymakers make actually affects you at who picks up the trash and, like, mm-hmm. all the, you know, the rules and regulations that folks don't think about that is decided by politicians, right? So that's what really drew me into politics at the local level, is really around my love for policy and policy changes. And I saw that politics was like one of the most direct way that you mm-hmm. can actually impact policy.
So from a very young age, I always had a righteousness about me that sometimes was laughable, but I think my close friends
can look at you now.
Yeah, I know. I think my close friends can identify with that statement. But I always wanted to do something that was about making the world a better place. So I went to law school, and I was in law school in Portland, Oregon, and I was on the trajectory to be a family law attorney, and a bunch of white people organized me to come into advocacy and to give up the practice of law and instead engage in political organizing. And they did a really good job, and I'm really grateful. They completely changed my life, and I'm so incredibly happy. And it was a moment, I had just graduated law school in Portland, Oregon, and I thought, oh, there's a state Democratic convention and I want to go. What is this about? I have an opinion. I want to be there. So I called the state Democratic Party and I said, I can't afford this ticket. It was something like $500. I had no money at the time. I just graduated school. I could barely pay my monthly bills. And I said, I want to go, but I can't afford it. How are you going to get me there? And they said, call the Oregon Bus Project. And I thought, why would I call a bus company? But it turns out the Oregon Bus Project, it's now under a different name in Oregon. It was a scrappy startup youth organizing project in Portland, Oregon. And its goal was to engage young people in politics. Instead of going to Wall Street, folks should stay in their communities and work to build a better community for everybody. And I called them because I wanted to go to this convention, and I was organized effectively. Their ED at the time said, come on in. I went to law school. Let's talk about law. Let's talk about law in Oregon. And we had this long conversation over a cup of coffee. And next thing I know, I'm volunteering with the bus project and I'm organizing young people and training them every day, helping them, not, you know, training them on canvassing, on phone banking, ratcheting up my debt and not paying my bills. But what I realized is that I could make a career out of making the world a better place. Mm-hmm. And if I could spend the 8 hours a day on what I truly cared about, that was an incredible gift and a privilege that I should take advantage of. So that's how I got involved. And I eventually ended up going into Wellstone Action, being a trainer, the former version of Repower. And it helped open my eyes to a whole national network of young people that were training other young people to be politically active. And it made me realize that I wasn't alone in wanting to make this world a better place. And I wasn't Pollyannish, and I wasn't naive, and I wasn't some silly young girl who didn't know what was going on. But actually, we could do this. And it wasn't just me doing it on my own, that I could join this team of folks all over the country. And it changed my life forever. And that's why I'm here today.
That's so great, because so many people, I know I was one of them, I never thought this could be a career, yeah, that you could actually just do this every day for a living. But part of that was because I didn't see any women who look like me who are able to do that, you know, really in Nevada. So I had to look far away. But then you're like, I can't be like them. Just like, no, I can't be like Donna and Mignon. Mm-hmm. So whenever I hear those stories, I think it's important, especially for us who are here now, because there are young girls who are listening, so they can know, like, yes, like, you actually can wake up and do this every day.
Yeah. So I started in election protection, also a lawyer, and Ohio was an original offender. We talk about Georgia and we talk about Florida now, but Ohio, mm-hmm, purging voters, all kinds of shiggity going on in elections, in the ballot box, in the, you know, precinct, executives having way too much power, people's vote, you know, voter registration just not showing up. And so when Barack Obama ran for office, the first time, I, as a lawyer, became a part of the voter protection team. Which was a group of lawyers throughout the state who helped to make sure that in every single precinct throughout our state, we made sure every vote counted. And so I got the bug a little bit there, and then worked on a study that our local women's fund and our local university was doing about why more women don't run. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to know, like, I had, at that point, I wasn't interested in actually being in politics, but I wanted to, like, why not, right? So I was a part of the steering committee, got lured into being a part of a focus group, and then eventually was asked to run for office by a woman who had been our mayor years before. And so I joined the elected ministry, is what we call it, and because you've got to be a saint to do it. And it was a beautiful thing. Like, I rejected it for a long time because I didn't think that you could be a good person, principled, honest, bold, and actually be successful in politics. But I thought, what do I have to lose? And I watched Barack Obama really be an example and others around me locally. And so let me try it, right? So it was interesting in that study that we did that the number one reason we found out that women don't run is because no one asked them to run. Mm-hmm. And probably the number two and number three reason that women don't run is, you know, the number two reason, we just don't believe that we can win. We don't feel as qualified as the men that we are more qualified than. Uh-huh. So I served for 6 years in Cincinnati City Council, President Pro Tem for 4 years of that. As you all know, ran to be in the year of the Black Woman Mayor in 2017 to be one of the first Black woman mayor of my city, won our primary, lost our general. But I can tell you that local politics is the heartbeat, you know. And I remember that the federal shutdown happened when I was a local elected official, and I was doing organizing in my community, talking to people about the issues that matter. And folks were like, are you guys going to shut down? And I was like, oh, honey, we cannot shut down. Not for one day, because you don't have trash collection, right. Your toilet won't, yeah, flush, the police, mm-hmm, don't show up, the ambulance won't come, the lights won't work. And so, like, local politics is ground zero for a lot of people. I had really big dreams about representing people who don't have a voice, and was able to do a lot of work at the local level, a lot more than I thought I could. And was bold and unapologetic in my advocacy for people who don't have a voice. And so coming into this movement space has been a little interesting, because I came through the electoral side, through the public leadership, and I've learned a ton about the bigger movement that ultimately supported me. I went through Wellstone. Another female political leader called me, and she said,
Wellstone, now Repower, has a training, Repower, we'll just call it that, has a training in Columbus. I paid your registration, getting your car and drive up tomorrow. And I was like, okay, I'm canceling my day tomorrow, and I'm going to go up. And I was trained through Repower before I was elected. Best training and best experience I could. I felt prepared. And so won my very first election, which never happens. Won re-election, which they didn't expect to happen, and was able to serve my city and my community. And I think that that is an important thing for folks who are trying to find a way to get involved. If you're not already doing organizing work or movement work, run for office. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really important thing to do. And I would venture to say that women are just better in elected leadership than men at all the things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We can hold people's interests, multiple different interests at heart. Right. We can empathize. We can make multiple decisions within, you know, minutes time. I mean, it's just, I think we're much more skilled and able to be leaders. No offense to my male friends and comrades in the movement.
Well, they know it. They're honest.
They do know it.
The other thing I would add too, and I was listening to Yvette speak, I also grew up in Ohio politics. Mm-hmm. We have our Ohio connection. But I would also say that there are leadership roles in politics that aren't necessarily folks that have to run for office. Mm-hmm. So my beginning, as I said, was through the policy angle. And I started working for the Ohio legislature. And the thing that I really think is critical when with all the young people that are listening, that you don't actually have to be the person who is the elected official. You can be the person who's making the elected make the decision. Right? Yes. So, you know, I always felt... And it was an interesting experience in Ohio where I was, you know, a young black woman who was, and if anyone knows Ohio, it's like a bunch of older white men. Mm-hmm. And so I had experiences of going into every room I was in when I was the young black girl who I was assumed to be his intern or the secretary. And I was his director of government affairs and the one who was advising him mm-hmm. of the decisions that he was making. So there are many paths in politics that young women can occupy that are all very powerful positions to be in. And because I love the legislative side of the work, that I like to encourage people to say too, that mm-hmm. that's not being an elected, although that is a path and you should serve and all of that, there's other roles in politics that are very influential that folks should think about as well.
And that's so true, because we need the representation across the spectrum. Yeah. We just did an event with women of color leading on Capitol Hill. And I really wanted to do that because most people don't think about Capitol Hill. And these are women with really big roles that are influencing policy. And we need more of them in that space. And I want to go back to something you said of that, because I feel it's really important to talk about when you talked about, can you actually be an honest person in politics? And for so many people, I think we can see, we're recording this on impeachment day, there are a lot of people who don't do this for the right reasons. They do abuse their power. It is for personal gain. So, like, how did you overcome that? Because I'll be honest, even thinking about politics, I was always like, well, I'm not going to be like that person at all. But then how do you just stay so focused on making sure it is about the people? And it's why I'm also very careful about choosing who is on the podcast, because they're all amazing people. But also everyone I have on, you also lift up other women of color, which I feel is very important when you're doing this work.
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is who you're serving. And as long as you keep your eye on who you're serving, it's impossible for you not to honor them with accountability over yourself and the things that you do. So I grew up really, really poor and ultimately served a lot of people who were also poor and didn't have an advantage. And I remember, you know, organizing in my community, getting people excited about the work that we were going to do. We had our slogan was the power of we. and the idea that it's not about me, it's about each and every one of us doing what we can do to make our community better. And folks would say, well, if you get elected, don't you forget about me. Don't become one of those politicians. You need to make sure you're serving me. But you're holding all of these people who are counting on you and all the little girls. So I'm going to tell you a story that might make you cry a little bit. So my first day on the dais, we haven't had a lot of black women serve at all. I was only the fifth woman, black woman, in the history of our entire city to serve on council. So my first day, this little black girl is sitting in the audience, and I'm conducting myself, and I step off, and this young girl comes up to me. She's with her mom, and she's about 13. Got a little swag about her, real cute. And she walked up to me, and she said, "You're beautiful, and you inspire me." It still chokes me up. And because she was like 13, like, you know, like she's walking up to me saying that, you know, and I didn't know what this, like, I was just like, thank you. And this seat will be for you. Work hard. Keep coming back. I'm here. And it was just, it reminded me that like every little brown girl and arguably every white girl, we haven't had that many women on our council, was looking to me as an example. And I just could not let them down. And so as easy as some people find it to go dirty or go low, we ran and served with integrity. And the funny thing is, even though we lost that general election, people still come up to me and say, you lost, but you won. Yeah. Because the way you ran and the way you served will always be remembered. Because it was a horribly dirty campaign run against me. And we never went low, not once. Yeah. And people remember that. And that will outlast any service that you have. And people still feel, they come up to me and they still feel like I honored them with my service.
I remember, and you did run a really great campaign. You had Jessica Byrd helping you out. And I just admired everything that you did. But even for me, I felt so seen in your campaign. Yeah. And I didn't even live in Ohio.
Yeah.
I was like going through my Facebook. I was like, who do I know in Ohio that I can send to volunteer, make sure that they're voting?
Yeah.
And I think that's the impact that you really had.
And that was the beautiful thing about having a sisterhood of women who were all running together. They called it the Essence, and Ebony called it the Year of the Black Woman Mayor. And, you know, folks like Tashara Jones and, you know, Vi Lyles and Keisha and I go, all of us were running together in the same year, you know. And it was one of those things where if we had all won, we would have literally doubled the number of women, 200% actually, the number of women serving as leaders of the top 100 cities. And we were all breaking glass, meaning we were the first. All of us would have been the first. And so having that camaraderie, having that sisterhood, and having people see us together, I still go around the country and people say, you're Yvette Simpson, you ran for mayor, right? And now we're the people's mayors of Wakanda, but that's fine. We'll have a conversation about that. But yeah, it was important because there were so many of us who were doing this together and breaking through together. And that sisterhood was really, really important. And I did feel loved and I did feel seen.
As we get closer and closer to the 2020 election, campaigns start to stretch their budgets to make every dollar count. That's why it's so important to make a donation to the candidate or the cause that you believe in at every stage and every race you can. As I always like to remind people, every dollar counts. One AdBlue donor, Katarina, summarized it best when she said, I'm a single mother with three kids and I watch every dollar in my budget, but I love the fact that I feel like I can move the needle just a little bit for my children's future by donating $5 at a time, and that my $5 is just as important as any billionaire's. It's really so true. Small dollar donors can make all the difference. AdBlue is a nonprofit organization dedicated to empowering small dollar donors like Katarina. They make it easy for grassroots supporters to make their voices heard and help thousands of Democratic campaigns, progressive organizations, and nonprofits build people-powered movements. Visit secure.adblue.com/about to learn more and become a donor yourself. That's secure.adblue.com/about. So I pulled up something on my phone because I do want to talk about policy some more. And I bookmarked this from Instagram. It came from Voto Latino, and I thought it was so perfect. So it says, you're just not that into politics. Your boss is, yep. your landlord is, yep. your insurance company is, and every day they use their political power to keep your pay low, raise your rent, and deny you coverage. It's time to get into politics.
Come on.
Right?
Can we go there?
We're about to talk about it.
Can we?
Because I still hear that doing this, meeting people, I'm just not into politics. Politics doesn't mm-hmm. impact me. And like every day you wake up, you are in some way impacted by politics. Yes. Like if you're able to turn on your lights, the water that you drink, the bus that you take, the roads that that bus is on. And especially as Black and Brown people, our lives are so inherently political yeah. because every policy just, it impacts us, mm-hmm. but it just impacts us in profound ways. So as organizers, what are just some examples of ways where you have seen political organizing have an impact on policy?
So the biggest scam ever in the history of our country was this belief that you shouldn't talk about politics. You shouldn't talk about politics at the dinner table. You shouldn't talk about it at work. People still tell me, well, I don't want to talk politics. I'm not into politics. Politics is into you. Mm-hmm. And I love the saying, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, right? Yes. This idea, and I can't believe, I'm like, where does that come from? That for some reason we're not supposed to talk about politics. And I think that was a scam. I think it was a message to keep us mm-hmm. from owning and wielding the power that we so need.
Speak on it.
There was a story that was released a couple years ago, and I can't remember what it was, but it was talking about the inverse relationship. The people who need politics the most are the least engaged. Mm-hmm. And they have been told, one, that they shouldn't talk about it, two, that it doesn't work, three, yeah. that they will never benefit from it. Four, that they shouldn't get involved in it. Mm-hmm. All lies. And I believe that that was a messaging scheme that was started long before I got here that mm-hmm. is carried over. And I think what we have to realize right now is what you said, is that the reason politics doesn't work for us is because we're not engaged. Mm-hmm. So when I was an elected official, I organized communities, poor and Black and Brown communities to show up. Because what happens in local politics and politics all across at every level is the squeaky wheel gets the oil. We'd have something that affected the suburban, rich, predominantly white communities, and they would show up and show out. It would be a zoning change. Mm-hmm. It would be a stop sign. It would be potholes. It would be, you know, one of the speed humps on the street, and they would show up like they were going to lose their life. And then we had these poor communities and these disenfranchised communities that for a lot of reasons didn't feel empowered, didn't have the ability, didn't have the information, were dissuaded from showing up. And so when we would have, I did a couple things. One, I required our clerk to always put the name of the community next to each item and to publish that and put that out before the vote. So you knew if your neighborhood was being impacted by an item so you could show up.
Transparency.
We did things like have evening meetings. I did meetings in the community. All my committee meetings we would do once a month in the community, bring it to them.
Talking about that scam reminded me of when I was younger mm-hmm. and I told my grandmother, who is an immigrant from Iran, no longer with us, I told her I'm going to stop practicing law. She wanted me to be a millionaire. She was like, your goal in life is to be rich. Yes. And I said, I'm going to stop practicing law. I'm going to go into grassroots organizing. And she pleaded with me in Farsi. Mm-hmm. My mom had to translate. Mm-hmm. Said, Grandma doesn't really want you to do this. She thinks it's a mistake. You need to be wealthy. And I didn't understand at the time. I was like 27. I said, why is she so committed to this? Like, I'm trying to do community organizing. This is really important for our community. And she said, in Iran, if you don't have money, you have no power. And so for her, she was looking out for my safety. And she didn't understand American democracy, cut to 2007, where we weren't facing an authoritarian president. But she didn't understand what I was viewing in American democracy is actually we can have power, and it's not about our pocketbook. It's about our ability to organize and mobilize people. And so when you ask about where have I seen political organizing work and be impactful, and and the dirty word of politics, I actually think we're in a moment in this country, and I think we've all seen it around this table here, where you've seen people that have never been active, politically active ever before in their life are showing up. I mean, I was at a rally today to support the U.S. House impeaching this president. And I saw someone with a sign that says, I used to be a voter, but now I'm an activist. Mm. I mean, there are people every day that are doing things that never, never crossed their mind their entire lifetimes. And these are like 70-year-old folks, 20-year-old folks, all up and down the age spectrum, all kinds of races. And folks are taking action. And the way I, the moment when I, you asked that question, the moment that comes to my mind is middle of 2017. We're fighting the Republicans in Congress to put an end to their attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Hundreds of times they voted to repeal the ACA. Thousands of people across this country protesting, from die-ins to local at local congressional offices to actions on the Hill. Such undeniable public pressure against Trump care that the U.S. House and Senate, controlled by Republicans at the time, couldn't win. We defeated them. And there was a moment, like 1 a.m. On the steps of the U.S. Senate, and we have a picture with U.S., you know, elected officials and activists all over this, the DMV area, on the steps just cheering for joy when we finally defeated Trump care. And we didn't, and like a defeat is not a win necessarily. I mean, we didn't pass the ACA, but we defeated their attempt to strip healthcare from hundreds of thousands of people in this country, and actually would have ended up killing people, like friends of mine, if they took away the healthcare that they have.
Yeah. You know, and as I was thinking about the question in terms of how I've seen it work, and Rona lifted up a really great example at the federal level, I want to think about the local level where I've seen it work several times. And the one moment where I've seen and just seen like the impact it's had across the country is the Fight for 15 movement. And really think about how when we talked about people and organizing people and the power of the collective group of folks that are mobilized to actually impact their bottom line. And we've seen this movement put hundreds of thousands of people in the street at any given moment. And like people who work at McDonald's and Burger King and other places who probably didn't think they had the power to collectively come together and mobilize to actually impact laws and changes at the local level, and who have now figured out how to collectively come together and realize the impact. And all across the country, minimum wages increases are happening everywhere. Massachusetts, New York, Seattle, like the minimum wage is being increased. And so for me, that is a time where I've really seen where organizing of people have actually had an impact, and it has had wide scale impact. And I'm like waiting for the moment that we start seeing enough states increasing the minimum wage to actually start getting the federal government to pay attention. And I would love for someone to send, you know, the, you know, federal electeds that 10-year challenge of the federal minimum wage, and how much, you know, it has not moved at all. And so anyways, I just wanted to lift up that example of the organizing of local people and how that's having impact across the country.
And Karundi, remember when that campaign started? Some of us in this room were there. I don't know about you, but I was highly skeptical. I was like, we're never going to do this. Yeah. Crazy Fight for 15. Ugh.
So that was really great. And it's also a segue into the next question. I mentioned earlier, it's very important to me to have women on the podcast who are about lifting up other women of color, because I'm here because of other women who believed in me, fully believe in paying it forward. At the end of the day, the BGG is all about uplifting the voices of women of color that are not in the mainstream media, even though we just talked about it. Everything disproportionately impacts us, but our voices aren't there. So how have other women of color lifted you up in your career?
This is one of those questions that is going to make me tear up. I'm going to lift up two women of color who has been really important and played really important roles in my life and in my career. The first is my mentor, Yvette McGee Brown.
Yeah, love her.
Love Yvette. She this like the woman I want to be when I grow up. But she was a judge at 30. She was the CEO of Nationwide's Children's Hospital, and ran as lieutenant governor for Governor Ted Strickland when he ran in 2010. Just a really badass woman who just, you know, took me under her wings and really sort of guided me when I was actually questioning, what do I do next? Because, you know, we lost in 2010, and I was always like, politics is where I'm going to be. This is my life, and I'm always going to do this work. And then when we lost the re-election, I was really sort of like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to keep losing. It's too hard. And we spent a few months together post-election. She lost. She ran as lieutenant governor, and she was comforting me, right? Like, she was just like, you know, and she really guided me and like answered a lot of the questions that I had, and like really started questioning myself, but she was really supportive. And I really was like, all right, maybe I can stay in politics somehow, but I don't want to be on the campaign trail anymore. And so I came to SEIU in 2011, and I had not worked at a union before. I'd never worked in labor before, but from afar, I'm like, labor is progressive. It's like doing all this amazing things for the people and, you know, standing up for the little guy, and I really want to be a part of that. And when I came to SEIU, my first mentor was Rana, and I met her at SEIU, and you know, I was like, how do I navigate this mammoth organization? Because I'm coming in with all of this experience as a, you know, a government affairs person. Like, you know, I'm a government affairs person. I'm not a movement. I don't know unions. I don't know labor. What do I do in this space? And Rana was the person who was just like, all right, let's sit down together. Let's think together. Let's talk together. We had coffees together. And Rana was like, all right, where do you want to be in 5 years? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I will help navigate all of this with you. And you know, she has been my friend since 2011. We met, and she's the person I can go to. Having mentors in your life who you can call to discuss your career and who can have your back and support you. And this woman has always had my back, period. And it's just, yeah, it's really good to have other women of color who have really just see you for what you're worth and who's reminding you every day that you're worth something, you're worthy. And whenever you have those moments of doubt that you can call on, it's like really important to have that. And I've got that in her, and
I've got it in you too. I mean, it went both ways, I'll say. I mean, I started my activism at a time where maybe I was in the wrong place, but I didn't see a lot of people helping each other out. It was kind of every man for themselves, every woman for themselves. And, you know, I started my activism career in Oregon, which is not a very demographically diverse place. So I remember a couple of folks that really helped me. One woman, African-American woman in Oregon, saw that I was being trained to be an organizer with, you know, not the best values. So the people that were training me were not really training me around solidarity, around racial justice, around equity. They were training me around winning at all costs. And she, I think with really good intentions, kind of straightened me out. She's like, you can't just ask the black leader to come to your table when you haven't even, you know, you've already set the table and you want me here. And it made me realize, oh, wait, what am I being taught here? So she opened my eyes. Joanne Hardesty, I don't know if anybody knows her. She's an amazing, I think she's on the city council now, or she's doing something amazing in Oregon at this point. And then when I came to SEIU, before I met Karundi, there is a woman, Sujata Tejwani, who many folks know.
Yes,
she's an incredible consultant, an incredible trainer, incredible mentor. And she, I don't know if she would articulate it this way, but in effect, she took me under her wing and I learned so much from her. And she created a safe space for me to be myself. She helped me strengthen my strengths and identify what those are and assured me that learning was part of the work and it's okay. And I owe a lot to her in the sense of like the confidence that I built and the skills that I developed and the space that she created for me to learn on the job. Until this day, she's a mentor and a friend of mine. And I would say I didn't really understand, I didn't really learn about solidarity about bringing other people along with you for the ride and to helping to create other leaders behind you. I didn't really get that until I started at SEIU. And I learned a lot about solidarity across racial lines, because if we can't stand strong, no matter where we come from in our background, the boss is going to break us along. They're going to try to break us along racial lines.
Right. That is so real.
Divide and conquer, so which is what we're seeing with this current administration. Mm-hmm. And I had women of color mentor me, Takesha Everett, Desiree Hoffman, many women that helped me guide me through union organizing and union politics, and to this day remain close friends. And I'd say, as a new executive director, with Yvette, with Karundi, with a whole long list of women of color that have come into leadership in the progressive movement, it's an incredible space we've created together to support one another in roles that are just really hard.
It's a sisterhood, and like, I can often feel it. Like, it's like something's, you know, we all been warring today. Like, how y'all doing? Y'all good? Mm. And it is important for us to hold each other up in that. And it's just a small thing, but it's a way to know that as we're traversing the country trying to save the world every day, that we're not alone. It's a real important thing. I have been blessed to have a ton of Black women, way too many to count, who have been like my encouragers and my shepherds and like my shoulders and like all of it. I'll try to give a few real quick. The first Black woman ever to win city council, Marion Spencer, we lost her this year, was my inspiration for running. My hope was that before she passed away that she could see the first Black woman become mayor. First Black woman win a primary. We didn't ultimately win the general. But she was in her 90s, helped integrate Coney Island, which was in our schools. Her and her sister were the first Black women to live in the dorms at our university. She broke so many barriers, and even in her 90s, she would always say, "Puddin', just keep fighting." And when she would call me Puddin', I'd be like, "Oh my God, I can do anything. I can do anything." Mm-hmm. And she just was so giving of herself. I would just be at her house and just sit at her feet, just on the carpet, and she would just tell me stories and encourage me. Nina Turner, who could be at this table too, because she was, you know, runs our revolution. When I first met her, my state senator took me to her office, and she just came up like she had known me my whole life and gave me the biggest hug. And
I'm envisioning. I can see it.
And Kamala Harris, who, as you know, recently dropped out of the presidential race, will never tell you, she checked on me throughout my mayor's race probably almost every week. Are you working out? Check on you? What is your team doing? Are they treating you right? Are you doing what you need to do? Mm-hmm. She did the same thing for Stacey Abrams. She did the same thing for Lauren Underwood. Mm-hmm. She was behind the scenes encouraging and supporting. And I'm a little Black girl in Cincinnati running for mayor. She's in California. was there for me. And never talked about it. She would never share that story.
And I love that you told those stories, because not everyone gets to see them, and especially that human side of those elected officials, you know, how they lift other people up, because again, we just see them as just these people who are there and the power. We don't get to see like their humanity and how they are about who they serve. And I have so many more questions. I have loved this conversation, but I do want to end with our signature question that we ask is, what advice do you have for the brown girls out there listening who are saying, "I want to be just like her"?
Believe in yourself. You know, I have a daughter. I'm a new mom. And it's amazing when I look at her and I imagine when I was small and I didn't think I could ever get to a place where I'm leading an organization. And also been in politics in really key leadership roles throughout my career. And I didn't think that I could do those things, because politics is a field that's really dominated by not, you know, a lot of Black women. And being in Ohio and being an intern and just training and training up, I didn't think I could do it. And I had other Black women telling me, "You're worthy. You can do this. You can actually do absolutely anything that you imagine that you can do." Just really believe in yourself, and then surround yourself with cheerleaders.
Yeah, I would say advice to young brown girls, you were born smart. Mm. And don't let anybody tell you otherwise. And any sign you're seeing that tells you otherwise, you're misinterpreting it. Or the person who's sending it to you don't know what they're talking about. You are born with smart instincts. You understand people. The things that this society values, such as what number you got on an SAT, you know, test, or whether you can, you know, do a math computation super quickly on the back of a napkin. Those aren't actually the only signs of wisdom or strength. Like emotional intelligence, ability to understand people, to build relationships, to build trust, to be genuine. That is the most valuable currency in the world, in my opinion. And I would double down on Karendi's advice to surround yourself with the cheerleaders.
My advice would be do it. Just that. Like, and trust yourself. Jessica Bird, who I should have invoked in that last question, is someone who has always told me, because I can get in my head, overthink, have to have a whole plan, figure out how it's going to go before I take that first step. That is a mistake. Got this gut thing that is so strong in women, so strong in women of color. Trust that thing. And imposter syndrome is real. And even if you get to a level where you feel like you've accomplished enough that you trust yourself, it's still hard to. Jessica Bird, when I call her and I tell her I want to do something new, she's like, great, do it. And I'm like, but I don't have a plan. But how am I going to fund it? And who's going to come along? And she's like, it's a great opportunity. You will figure it out because that's who you are. And so trust yourself and don't have to, you don't have to know how the end's going to be to start. And I think a lot of women, we psych ourselves out. We talk ourselves out of things because we don't think that we know how the end is going to be. But trust your gut. And I always say at the end of the day, when I, you know, head heart agreement is really, really important. It's one of the ways that I always judge myself. If my head and my heart are aligned, then I know I need to do it. But if my head is confusing me, I always trust my heart and my gut and my soul, my spirit. And so I just think so many women wait for all of the things to line up, for all of the signs and signals, for somebody to tell us 1,000 times for us to be sure that we can and that we're able, and we overthink it and we miss a window or an opportunity. So I would say if you want to change the world, which is what we aim to do as Black women, women of color, movement leaders, do it.
Y'all are all amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to spread all of your knowledge and wisdom with our listeners. And I know I personally appreciate all of you for the work that you do every day to get up and save the world. Thank you, my sisters. Make sure you visit the show notes to find the websites for these great organizations. A special thank you to The Outrage for hosting this live discussion. And a special thanks to AdBlue for sponsoring this episode. Stay up to date with us on the BGG website, www.thebgguide.com, and on our social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at The BG Guide, in between episodes.